mine's just more habit than anything else. It's just like in the moments where I would normally have had the smoking habit, I'm now like, do you know what? I've been doing it more as I've progressed, but not to any extent where I'm like, this is an issue. Like, it's still.
Gonna do us a favour, Dave. Gonna go and have a listen. Just put the headphones on, just make sure there's no buzzing. You'll hear hiss.
Aye.
All good.
More than I was initially doing it, but not to the extent where I'm worried about it. Like, and it's. People go, it's worse for you than smoking. I'm like, I don't know how, but I'm sure maybe somebody will have a study or some shit somewhere.
There's no proof yet.
But like, people are talking to me, like, it's worse. And I'm like, it's like.
I think some people react to it badly. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I think some people probably, it's worse, but it'll probably be a lesser percentage. It's all bad.
Yeah.
I mean,
of course it is. None of it's good for you. None of it's preserving your life. But
no, exactly.
I don't understand how, like, smoking a water vapor with nicotine on it can be as bad for you as smoking tar.
No, near there.
Nah.
I had a guy in here the other day saying that disposable vapes are part of, like, the global agenda. And he was like, that's why they're making all colourful and that for the wage, man. They'll just try and get kids hooked on it, man.
I swear to God. See, the mayor, you tell me about what people come in here and say. Are we recording, by the way? The more you tell me about what people come in here and say, the more I want to start setting this place up as, like, remember that TV show To Catch a Predator? They'd have a house and they'd be like, I'm a really hot 14-year-old girl, come on run. And then they'd have all these pedos come running and they'd be like, fucking busted. Like, I want to start using your studio as a trap for fucking idiots. So they can come run and I can be like, come here, you need a fucking slap.
Sometimes I'm the biggest idiot here, so.
No, I don't mean you.
No, I'm kidding on. But no, you're right. Sometimes I just sit here and I'm just like that. Like, oh no, man, see the vapes, man. You're part of the agenda. He's like, that's
the globalist agenda, big man.
That's why it's all multicoloured, because of the rainbow flag, right? That's what he was saying.
Oh, fuck. I thought you were joking.
This is what guy said. Because of the rainbow flag, getting them indoctrinated and then getting them hooked on vapes. And then thing mean the lungs, then he can't fight and blah blah blah. That's
then
the
they
guy,
can't fight.
That's what he was, this is what the guy was saying. He's like, so then you can't do it when you're trying to fucking fight them and all that. And I was just like, what the fuck?
Change the name of the studio to the Trap House. There, there.
The Trap House.
There.
Right. Anyway.
Aye. So hello and welcome to what will eventually be episode 138. After we get the bits and pieces out. We obviously had a wee bit of change in the last couple of weeks. And really want to just take a minute to, like, thank people for their support. We did mention it on Twitter a few times, but, like, the engagement in the last couple of weeks has been phenomenal and really something that, you know, justified some of the changes that we made. So we're going to continue down that road. We will get some snippets out, but we will still stick to the, you know, the longer podcast. I was really surprised to see how many people still engaged with, like, the full-form podcast, even though the wee clips and snippets did just great numbers by comparison to what we're used to so far. So thanks to everybody who got involved, you know, spoke to a few people in comments and, you know, YouTube and stuff like that, which was a nice wee change as well. That was great. And it's good to be back. Obviously, you know, the whole point was to be regular. I had a few issues with a family member being no well, and it's just not been possible to get in. So, you know, hopefully we can draw a wee line under it and get things moving as we sort of planned again.
Yeah,
suppose we better start by letting Shep get his fucking dumps in since Scotland are absolute gash, eh?
Well, I mean, it was a decent performance from England, to be fair, and Scotland were not as good as they actually have been more recently. So it's unfortunate, like, and then obviously Harry Maguire pulled up a blind.
The stick,
a
he's getting as harsh, so it is, like, I know he's made mistakes and everything, but
I do feel bad for him, to be honest.
Like, I do a wee bit as well.
I was probably the instigator of all of it, because I've been saying this for a while, and, like, me and my brother have been taking the piss out of it for a while. Like, I was actually quite shocked the last United game against Arsenal, because obviously you saw Arsenal fans cheer when he came on at that point, and I knew that it was game over at 1-0 at that point.
Yeah.
And I knew that he was going to be one of the reasons for that. But what I was surprised by was nobody passed him. Like, it was evident that the goalkeeper, the defence, nobody, like, and in our team in wanted to pass to him. Like, it was quite sad. Like, and Yeah, I think like his mum did a tweet today.
I think she did, which I don't did think will she? Have helped. Oh, no. His mum came to his defence on Twitter today. So, she did that.
So yeah, I think he's going to...
You know, things are bad when your mum's like, whole fucking rap at you lot. Aye. You know what I mean? Like,
and the thing is, it's not even like... We're talking about United right now. Like, he's not exactly the biggest problem at the United squad right now. So, like, I think we should probably be like... I mean, give him a break.
Aye. He's a bit of a victim of the whole, like... The English player tax, in the sense that he's probably a very competent footballer in certain respects, who's, you know, probably been maybe promoted above his ability level, generally speaking, and then coming with that like £75 million price tag, even in the day's market, that's a lot of money, and it puts a lot of pressure on performance. So, like, you know, over the years, I think that has been a bit of an albatross around his neck, and yeah, eventually, even somebody with the strongest mentality is going to buckle when everybody everywhere is like, you are shit. You know what I mean? Like,
I think part of the problem is also the fact that he's gone to a team that's meant to be a forward-pressing team. He can't play with space behind him, so it's bad recruiting from United's point of view. Yeah. He played well at Leicester because they were a counter-attacking team. He could just sit back, sometimes play out of defence.
Yep.
Same with Hull. Like, these are teams that there's a big transition into a team that needs to be pushing and passing, good at passing, and has a different level of.
We found that way. The Irish guy came to Celtic. Obviously, different levels. We're talking like
Duffy,
the top six of the English Premier League versus, you know, coming to Celtic. But
a different type of game was expected.
It's a completely different, Brighton. Completely different way of playing. Completely different pressures, different mentality, and. You see guys go into the types of environments and they just crumble. And so, I feel bad for Harry Maguire in the sense that it's not his fault he's getting picked for England. Like, there's been this whole, like...
He doesn't pick a team.
And I also, I'm like, how the fuck does Harry Maguire get into that fucking England squad? Like, that's a disgrace. Doesn't he, you know, he's not even in fucking...
Was he played, like, 40 minutes of football or something?
Aye, and also, I think the thing that annoys me as an England fan is that Tomori sitting on the not being getting a call up, and he's a fantastic player for AC
then
Milan.
I think Southgate, when he came in, was like, I'm creating a club atmosphere, so I get that he's trying to keep that group of players together as long as possible, but at the same time, either are like obvious players that should be there. I mean, from my point of view, my patriotism when it comes to the Scottish national team recently has extended to like not watching the games, and like in that respect I'm claiming several assists. And I really should be like noted on like live score at this point when Scotland get a win and it's pure assist. Matt didn't watch
it. Didn't watch the game, right?
Aye,
because jinx.
It's like game theory, right? Because I'm like, one, Steve Clark, great manager in respect what we need and the results that he's getting. I don't want to disrespect him in that regard, right? But he plays a brand of football and always has done that would make your eyes fucking bleed, right? Uh-huh. So for me, my thought process is I can watch Scotland be dull as fuck and get beat and be raging and we get beat, or I could not watch Scotland and not be raging that we're shite and we get beat. That's fine. But on the flip side of it, I could watch us be shite and win and still be like, that was shite, but we won. Whereas if I don't watch it and we win, I'm like, yes, we won,
right.
And I avoided watching a shite football match.
So I take it you watched it all night.
So I watched it against England, aye. So that one's technically probably on me as well, you know what I mean? It was like a big 7-foot bully hodding a toddler by the forehead. So it was like... It was
almost like, it was also a bit of a, like, it was like Bellingham and Kane cut, like, after their big moves. It was kind of like, I felt like Bellingham was really sort of showing off a wee bit.
That guy was on another level. Everybody else so on that good. Park, mate.
He's also a bit of a wank. Like, I'm going to say it. Like, and to be honest with you, as a 20-year-old and as a first-team pick for Man... as a first-team pick for Real Madrid, literally reopened the Bernabeu and scored a 95th-minute winner, I'd be swagging about, like, my fucking dick was, like, 18 inches long, you know what I mean? Like, so, I'm not saying I don't understand it, but he's still a bit of a prick. And he has a bit of a thing that I think some of the Scotland team missed on Tuesday night or Wednesday night, whenever it was a wee bit of that needle. Like, you've seen Walker wasn't shy about putting the boot in, Bellingham wasn't shy about putting the boot in, Phillips wasn't shy about putting the boot in, and the Scotland players didn't respond to it. And for all the talk, the Hampden roar and the passion and blah, 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 I mean, I was watching it on the telly and it sounded like the Scotland fans never got there at the 68th minute when Harry Maguire knocked the ball in his own net. You know
surely,
what I mean? Like,
surely, like, the Scotland have their eye on something else. Like, as much as it's a friendly, like, as much as, like, these guys play week in, week out against each other anyway.
Yeah.
Like, so it's not, like, a big occasion for a lot of the Scotland players. Like, they are a good... It should be. Like, nah. And I know it was, like, 100...
Half of them are English, but that's maybe the problem. You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah, well, that's true as well. But I just think, like, they've got a big game coming up, which is going to be the
you're saying that there's bigger fish to fry, right? But I just didn't understand the whole build up to it, because you're talking about, like, no disrespect to Scotland team, there's a couple of really good players in there, right? But you're talking about coming up against an England team that have got at least, what do you think, like 7-8 world class players in that?
Half of them weren't even playing,
right? And we're winding it up, and we're actually like, I'm a weird Scotland fan. I've only became a Scottish national team fan maybe since 2014, I'll be honest, like since the independence referendum.
Aye.
Before that, I always found it a bit cringy, the Tartan Army, and you know, like, oh, we're the ones that everybody wants there, but we're no good enough to get. I always found it a wee bit like...
The glorious defeat.
Uh-huh.
And there's only so much really you can tolerate
it.
That.
Never really liked it. I also went to Hampden once in my early 20s, and they were, you know, slinging sectarian slurs at Celtic players and stuff like the Tartan Army. So
yeah.
A young adult age, I was like, do you know what? Fuck them. But see, like, the whole build-up to it, and, like, this is the best time. Scotland are in the ascendancy. England they were crap against Ukraine, blah, blah. You're talking about we've baited guys like Kyle Walker to come out and actually have a bit about them and go, do you know what? No, fuck yous, we're going to beat you in your own back garden. You're like, you don't want that. Like, how about we just shut up and go about our business, mm-hmm. and maybe if we get a good result, you can then start talking about how well we're doing. Because we went in, like Dave's saying, like, we didn't look as good as what we have. Maybe because it's not a competitive game, or
maybe,
you know,
the occasion got the better of some people, possibly, as well. But I think it shouldn't be lost, the wider context of where Scotland are now. Like, we're in great shape. For the first time in 20 years, we're beating teams that we should beat regularly. We're also beating some teams that we probably shouldn't beat. And that's a nice wee change. And, you know, England are in whatever the top five, like, they're on a different level again, and we're at, like, you know, sort of 60%, you know what I mean, like 70% maybe. But I think the wider context is still quite rosy. Like, we're a win away for, you know, another back-to-back European Championship qualifications. It's not to take anything from you. I actually think the team should just draw a line under this one and just forget about it, to be honest with you. Because, again, it was a friendly. As much as in the moment you have that, all right, get into them, I don't think they should be, like, changing anything off the back yet. They should just carry on the path that they're on. What I did find funny was, as you were saying, about how unwelcoming the experience of being a Scotland fan had been for you, the coin has kind of flipped on that one now, where you can see a lot of Rangers fans claiming that they can't be welcomed amongst it. And even see it with, like, that fuckstick Ally McCoist, like, I honest to God don't know how that guy is, like, in a job, because... See,
really?
Honestly, like...
I like
Ally McCoist.
I fucking hate him.
I really like Ally McCoist. He's my favourite commentator.
No, man. he has so many, like, stock phrases that he repeatedly uses to let his brain catch up with his mouth that it does my fucking nothing. I have to tell you, you know, I really need to say, or if I'm being honest, and, like, he has these, like, stock phrases, and he literally uses, instead of just taking two mere seconds to think about what he's going to say, he has that thing where he feels like he's got to say something, and what he says is just, it's just white noise. Like, and then, obviously, one of the things he did say was, you know, when the English national anthem was booed, because nobody at a Scotland-England match has ever booed the opposition's national anthem. You know, it was very much given it the whole, oh yeah, the SNP fans in the crowd, and you're like, shut the fuck up, mate.
Aye, it doesn't, like, need to become
cultural,
does it?
You're there to commentate on sport, like, and that's where his mask slipped for me, is that, you know, oh, how dare they boo God Save the King, and you're like, mate, you've played for Scotland. You've played for Scotland against England. What the fuck are you talking about?
I wonder what the...
Shut up.
To be able to... And I'm sure we could go back on YouTube and see what the reaction was at Wembley in 96 when they played the floor of Scotland.
Because the England fans all stood to a man in complete silence and honoured it. Nothing about how they booed Craig Brown's minute silence, you know, Scotland legend.
I found that a wee bit... I did find that a wee bit in the sort of, like, post... match and a bit of the commentary around the game, it was all about the national anthem, and nobody really brought up the fact that they, you know, Craig Brown's a Scottish football legend, for, you know, I would say, and the guy died and they had a minute's silence, and there was a bit of boon coming for the England game. But how do you feel about this, Dave? Suppose, like, me and Matt are Irish Catholic descendant Celtic supporting East End of Glasgow.
Any football rivalry at any level, but, I want that disrespect. I want it. I'm like, give me your disrespect, because I'm going to throw it back in your face when we beat you. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like,
what's your take on the Scottish fans booing God Save the King? Do you find it disrespectful? I think this is the whole thing, was have a bit of respect and blah, blah, blah.
Nah, like obviously, like, I don't give a fuck about the king and all that anyway, so I'm not like I might support the England football team, I don't support like the British government
and the monarchy.
Yeah. I don't support the monarchy, like all that stuff, it's all pamp and like whatever, like it's a bit shit. Like, it's when you watch the rugby and they start singing the anthem in the middle of a game, like whether it's like a Flower of Scotland started and like against South Africa and stuff, I guess the blood going, and it's all tribal, and I think that's good. I don't think the whole pomp and ceremony and all that whole respect thing, I don't really care about a lot of it. Like, it's kind of like the haka as well. Like, that's the biggest form of, like, it's amazing. It, like, gets your hairs on the end, on like goosebumps shit.
But it's intended to intimidate the opposition.
It's a war dance, right?
Exactly.
And then there's been times in the past where the opposition team have sort of stepped forward to it, which is accepting the challenge. Aye. And they get criticised sometimes, which I think is, why would you get criticised?
I
think that's happened before as well.
Dance,
but I think,
all you want.
I think that's I think that's a fair reaction. Like, if you're invoking that spirit and that competition, then fucking go with it the whole way. Like, fucking right. So, yeah. But like, so I don't agree with like minute silences for respect for that kind of thing. And it's the same as like, well, as anything.
That's
like
why I prefer the minute of pause, the way the Italians and the Europeans do. I much prefer that, because it takes this like full outrage completely out of the equation. Aye. Like, they go, Craig Brown was a legend, you know, served as national manager, played and managed all levels of the game, has earned a level of professional and sort of personal respect. Like, as a result, could you please stand and join in a minute's applause? And then anybody who wants to boo it gets drowned out with 60,000 people applauding.
Yeah, it's a good shout.
You know what I mean? I don't get it. It's such a
no, I think that's,
you know.
Yeah. But the other side of what you were saying, and something that I've always kind of found, like, as someone that clearly sounds pretty Scottish to most people, and in England I just sound Scottish, but I was born in Bath and I moved up here very young, but because of my bigger brother I support obviously the English side of things, which I'm fine with. A lot of my family are Welsh as well, so I'm British pretty much, which is fine. But I would say that, like, I got a lot of fucking abuse as a kid, like, from folk for wearing, like, an England top. Just going to, like, football. Going to football training. Just going to, like, train football, like, get hacked and, you know, worst tackle. Like quite evidently. Which is fine. It does make you stronger at times. But I would say that it's definitely, like, Scotland cares a lot more about this than England.
Yeah.
That's always been the case. Like, England have rivalries with people like Argentina and people like that who are probably afar.
Yeah. I mean, it is the most played international fixture of all time.
It was the first one, wasn't it? That's what the Now, was.
The modern history is heavily in England's favour, but I've seen a stat pre-match about the overall, and it's surprisingly even.
I think it's so, like, it's sort of like 43 victories to Scotland, 49 to England.
There's like a few in it in England's favour.
And then a load of draws. But in the last 30 years, Scotland have only won once. So the last
They were saying like 87, 85 or something like that.
Well, we beat them at Wembley in a playoff under Craig Brown.
And Don Hutchison.
I think that's the only one. And
I think that was a friendly. That was like,
no, it was a two-legged Euro playoff. They beat us 2-0 at Hampden on the Saturday in Scholes.
Because that was the last game at the old Wembley that Hutchison scored on.
I'm pretty sure that was a two-legged Euro 2000 playoff in 1999, and they beat us England beat Scotland 2-1 in aggregate.
So there's a really bad show, right? I only watched like maybe three episodes of it, right? but there's a show, and I'm sure it's on Netflix, and it's kind of like about the origins of football, right? But it's done as a drama. So it sort of talks about like the factories that basically the very first ones that this guy basically said to some of the Scottish workers that were in this team, I need you to come and work at my factory. Gave them like really good positions, essentially the first time building a football team. And it brings like the whole idea, well, the fact that Scottish players were the first ones to come down and basically introduce like passing and like bringing in a basic formation, and it takes you through that. I kind of enjoyed it for the fact of what the subject was, you know, but I was kind of like, this is also very like
cheesy.
Yeah, a wee bit, but it was done pretty well, like, don't get me wrong, and like it's quite like an interesting like topic, I guess, but I think I would have rather it been like just a quick hour and a half documentary than a docu-series like that's all like trying to be dramatized and having like footballers' wives part at the side probably and shit, you know. But it was interesting because there was a lot of like the team, like it has the whole idea of like the best teams at the time were just these like Oxford colleges and things like that for whatever reason, and these guys came in and destroyed them with new tactics and stuff.
I listened to you're talking about there about Scotland caring more. I listened to, is it Simon Jordan? Is that the guy's name?
The guy who used to run Crystal Palace.
I had Talk Sport with Jim White. He's and he prick. Said something, and I was like, I'm going to rewind that and see if this is what he actually said. He said,
he talks some shite, though.
He talks some amount of shite.
He always has.
He talks utter nonsense, but he was saying a similar sort of thing, like, this matters more to Scotland than it does to England. And then he went, unless we get beat. He's like, if we get beat, then we care. And I was like, well, then you care. The difference between it is that you think that you're going to win, so therefore you're like, we don't really care about this, but if you beat us, then we care. Well, then you fucking care. That's a ridiculous... That is just...
I think it's seen in some of the conversations as well, the difference in mentality, particularly for the media.
It's so stupid to say that. We only care if we get beat, but then you fucking care about the money. I don't care about money.
He's in his own
unless
paradox.
I lose it all, and then I care about money. It's like, well, then you fucking care about money. Like that. Yep. You just got a lot of it.
But I think the way you see Steve Clarke in the press, you know, the Scottish team currently are kind of enjoying the ride and really like sort of riding high, and hopefully we'll continue to do so, at least through this sort of qualification and whatnot. But then you juxtapose that against like Gareth Southgate, who came off the park against the Ukraine like a couple of days beforehand, won each draw, and the first question to him for the guy post-match was, that's a shame that you can't qualify to October now, eh? And you're like, you're just assuming that they have this God-given right to, you know, be at these tournaments and whatever else, and you're like, aye, there's that difference in those two sort of outlooks was quite prominent in the last few weeks, where everything with Scotland is all positive because we're actually playing like a football team and getting results, and then England drop a couple of points and it's like, ah, it'll be fine, you know. I mean, it's just like,
but there is a kind of, like, there is a reality behind that. Yeah,
there
like,
is a reality.
Like, England, when England didn't qualify, which was, what, Steve McLaren or whatever for Portugal, I think it was, like, it was, like, a big thing because, and it's the same when, like, Italy don't qualify or, and like, these other, Sweden even get, like, quite a big rap when they don't qualify. So, like, yeah, and it is a big thing when Scotland qualify. Like so I get,
no,
like,
and what I did see about,
I didn't see much of the pre-build-up, right? I avoid all that stuff, right? But I did, when I did see Steve Clarke talking before the game, he did say, like, the job is to get regular qualification. That's the step we're at. We're not at the step of competing and getting to the quarterfinals, semifinals like England. That is their expectation. And that also brings, like, all the additional pressure and expectation from, you know, some of the worst fans and media as well. So that's why you end up with people like Harry Maguire, who's 100% going to end up checking into fucking rehab soon.
I know.
But anyway, hopefully, I do have a bit, I have a lot of faith in like United fans. I think after that England game, I think the Man United fans are going to turn and back. And,
well, I hope they fucking do.
Like, give the fucking lad a chance. He'll end up scoring a winner against fucking City or something. Swear to God, like,
he's probably due one, to be fair. You know what I mean? Like, for the stick he's taking pop up my dad.
He can ping
like
a ball. Like, he can ping it, that left peg.
So, I think we'll move on. Last couple of weeks, we've or the last couple of episodes. Well, we could, aye, quite easily. Get ourselves a wee side gig as a football podcast. But I think the last couple of sort of mini episodes, we're getting quite deep into the sort of cinema side of things. So probably, like, I'd like to like just bring it back to like what's going on round about in, you know, Scotland and the UK this week, and kind of pivot back to some of the stuff that we kind of normally talk about. For me, like, we've spoke off mic, but I don't know, man, I didn't think that the Tories could get any worse than they already were, because they have been an incompetent shit show for like 13 years now. But like, seeing the last couple of weeks, it's like almost like the last days of Rome type thing going on, where, you know, we had the first one that kind of jumps out to me is this like Bibby Stockholm barge that was there in recent weeks. And again, it's just like the next step in the sort of dehumanisation of like immigrants and refugees. Because, as we've said in previous episodes, they want them as an election talking point. You know what I mean? The French are still sitting in France going, we'll help you set up some offices here and we'll just fix this. And they're like, no, we don't want to fix it. We want this as an election issue, because it's the only thing that actually keeps us in the mix, is that the country is riddled head to toe with fucking racists. And we get to point at these people and be like, oh, these guys are the problem. And it's went from Rwanda to, you know, that's, where are we with that? That's not happening, it's bullshit, it's pie in the sky nonsense, well, that it's cost us.
We're still talking about it, now.
Exactly, we? Because they've went, well, if we can't get them off of British soil by sending them to Rwanda, we'll get them off of British soil by basically patting them on a floating prison in the sea. And you're like, that is like some sort of fucking shitty Bond movie.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, where it's like, you know, the you know, the island, you know, the Dr. Evil island.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, except this is just stacks and stacks of, like, you know,
containers.
Aye, like shipping containers.
With legionnaires.
Aye, and this is the thing. They were told up front, and this is what got me about it, was that they were like, these are not, like, hygienic.
Fit for purpose.
These are not fit for purpose. This is going to lead to, like, legionnaires outbreaks and such and such. And they were like, aye, fuck it, we don't care. Like, pop them on. What did they get, like 15 people on that barge before they had to take them all back off again because of legionnaires? And you're like, you were told this was going to happen, and you were like, we don't care. And then the minute it happened, you were like, oh Christ, get everybody, you know what I mean? Because they'll leave themselves liable to all sorts of legal challenges and all the rest of it. So even though they knew it was going to happen, they went away, and it's like an exercise in shooting yourself in the foot. So it's like, and I'm like, I don't get what the thought process behind it was. They're saying something like it cost whatever it is, £2.8 billion to, are they renting, or did they outright buy these? I think they're renting.
No, I think they're renting it.
They're renting these barges, right? And the total cost them like £2.8 billion for a country that, well, we kind of just find money whenever we need it. You know, like,
magic,
oh, why?
Money tree.
But they were comparing it, and this was the one that I loved about it. They were comparing it to, what is it, the fucking, the sea line, the
Titanic.
Well, aye, probably a bit, that's probably a mere apt comparison, aye, you know,
a P&O cruise,
but the, you know, the jewel of the sea.
Oh right, aye, like the what's aye, like the jewel blue, of the sea is like the biggest cruise line.
And it's got like flumes and fucking cinemas, and
yeah,
like you can basically go live there. It's like a floating city.
Uh-huh.
This thing costs like £800 million to make, and you're like, this like barge in the sea is like three
so
times more expensive,
cruise liner,
and nobody can use it.
Aye, like a luxury cruise liner that takes middle and upper class people run the Mediterranean while, like, you know, having shows, and I think they make puzzles and all sorts of fucking nonsense, right? Costs £800 million to build, and you can own it, £800 million. But instead, they spent £2 billion on renting some fucking shipping containers.
Remember, right? So most of the money will have gone into middle management and people who are sitting around talking about it.
Sorry, you were just
talking. So sitting around talking about it in terms of like in terms of taking money out of that pot. So it's a money grab, like you say. Any money that it'll be like a Tory party member's spouse that owns the contracting company for the fucking barge.
Yep.
So again, it's just going to be another 2.8 billion or whatever it is, 1.8 billion. That's just gone straight into the back pockets of the fucking Tories, like before they get fucking dethroned.
And it's not as if that's new, because alongside that we've got an environmental secretary who's got £70,000 worth of shares in Shell. There's, you know, that education secretary who is, I do a fucking good job and people should basically applaud me, while like schools all in the country crumble, as like palming off millions of pounds of like construction work to her husband's company. Like even the Prime Minister, Sunak, is changing laws that directly affect his wife's businesses. Like he had to come out the other week there and apologise for a change in the law that coincidentally made his wife's company £20 million. Mm. You know, I didn't realise that she was involved. Like, what? You know what I mean? Like, so that like money grab is such a part. And it's like, as I was saying about the last days of Rome, it's like people just sitting with like bin bags just being like, fucking, well, this take all it, on, take it? All
like,
it.
I don't know, like, it's either...
Feels too obvious. It's so obvious.
It is so obvious. It's either that or we are literally being ruled by a bunch of morons. But I don't think that that's the case. I think it
could be both.
Could be a mix.
Some are column A, some are column B.
I think they're morons in wolves' clothing. Like they're fucking like
playing the idiot. They play the idiot.
Like you look at Boris. Like Boris has done that his whole fucking life. The guy's not stupid. Like even fucking even Trump does it. Like it's so obvious.
Aye. Could be the everyman. We're just like you.
Mm. And then then you get people that are just like a bumbling, you know, like getting fucking a bulldog in one chest, but a fucking Boris tattoo in another. But, it's literally they know that they're on the way out, and I just don't think they give a fuck. I think they've gave up in that respect.
They've totally gave up,
and they're just trying to siphon as much money for the people that have put them into this position as they'll try to get them as much as possible. Yeah. I think that is literally what's going on.
Like, and it's been going on since the pandemic and beyond. Like, you know, austerity and all these things were about siphoning, and like Owen Jones wrote about whatever 10 years ago about it, you know, it's welfare when Joe Public loses his job and wants to, you know, get 50 quid a week off the government. But when, you know, corporations want tax cuts or banks want to build out, it's in the national interest, but it's still corporate welfare. You know what I mean? Like, it's moved beyond that now to like straight up corruption, when you've got, you know, PPE scandals and, you know, all the rest of the stuff that went on there, where the pandemic was used as a sort of prima facie for just straight up fucking robbery. You know what I mean? And it's now continuing on beyond that again. I think the incompetence is also there, like front and centre as well. I mean, you look at like this week, right? There's the Tory party have had to come out and like address the fact that the guy who they put on as a researcher on the China desk is an actual fucking Chinese spy. Like, the guy's got lifted, right? So that putting the guy who is like actively being accused of reporting back to China on the China desk in government, and you're just like, how does that happen? Like, how little do you need to care about what it is that you're doing that you actually let like a Chinese spy essentially run the fucking China desk at government? You know what I mean? Like,
how do our secret services not pick up
on that? Who knows that they don't, because they picked up on the Russian guy that Boris Johnson was swanning about before he became Prime Minister and went, you can't make this guy a lord. He's an obvious foreign agent, and he just went ahead and did it anyway.
They did anyway. The intelligence community
are only to advise.
They're only there to relay information, and they can't really do much about it. But
Johnson literally fucked off for a G7 summit in Italy and slipped his detail to go on a 3-day bender with his Russian pal, you know what I mean, like, and come back, and they were like, what did you get up to for the last 3 days? And he was like, fuck you, you know what I mean? Like, that's mere mendacious, but this is like incompetence on a level that you're talking about, there is an obvious stupidity involved in that decision making process, that what vetting and whatever else, they're like, we don't give a fuck about that. She said, they're like, we're on the way out, just if he wants the chain desk, give him the China desk, fuck yeah. It, you know what I mean, like, there's a Chinese spy allegedly.
I think they were out the day given it that the Labour like you're talking about, just wanting to create talking points for like political campaigning, they've already, they came out the day and they were saying that, I think their tagline is that if you vote for Labour, we'll become a dumping ground for immigrants. They actually think that it's like this weird thing that you see happening in America as well, where they're like, Biden's a communist, and you're
oh my God, man, that place has been off the deep end.
It's like, what world do you live in? Like, I seen somebody the other day on a podcast say that Biden's government's a Bolshevik invasion. You're like, what world, like... You just don't live in any form of reality. Like, they're going to be trying... how are the Tories going to paint Keir Starmer's Labour as some sort of loony left wing? Like, I don't see how that they're going to be able to try.
They'll do the way they've always done it, and they'll have their mates in the right wing press hatchet job them at every opportunity.
What, you think they'll try and red Edom?
Oh, like, fuck.
How are they going to do that to Sir Keir, who's a fucking been, you know, like, a lawyer and... prosecuted everybody under, like, you know, he's a law and order.
Facts don't matter anymore.
Surely he's going to be a campaigning on, like, I'm a law and order prime minister, and, you know,
Corbyn supported him.
He would expect
that. So that's it.
What's that?
Corbyn supported him.
His friend. I seen that. There was, like, the clip of him saying, Jeremy Corbyn's a personal friend of mine, like, back when he was running for leadership, and it's like.
And even with the Tories now, like, you go, the thing last week, what was it, the other spy, the Iranian spy who was in the British Army, you know what I mean? Like, who the guy who was at Wandsworth, this guy escaped. This guy was in prison, charged for being an Iranian spy in the British Army.
Is that why he was in prison?
He was in prison explicitly for that, right? Now, they put him in no maximum security, but whatever the one under maximum security is, right? So, one. Show me anybody anywhere on a fucking espionage charge that is in, like, pure, like, medium security, right? The prison itself, and I don't know if you've seen some of the pictures of it, the guys who are the head of the prison services have been like, we've been screaming about this for 10 years. Like, the prison is, like, Victorian.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean that in the sense that, oh, look at all the lovely, like, Victorian brickwork and all that.
Aye,
see when you go inside it. Aye, it's like some not a fucking Dracula movie.
Uh-huh.
So it is like Victorian, uh-huh, like in the sense that it's like a fucking old school workhouse. You know what I mean? Like, so this guy, this Iranian spy, managed to get a job in the kitchen. So not only is he not in maximum security, he somehow manages to get a job in the kitchen where there are, and this is a guy who's army trained, where there are, like, knives and all sorts of implements that he could use to, like, seriously harm other prisoners, right? Doesn't he do that? Somehow manages to fashion straps that he uses to, like, basically cling under a food van that's coming in and out the kitchen. Uh-huh. And then gets through, like, multiple levels of security that each involve searches under vehicles. Amazing. So they missed him at three different gates.
Amazing.
He then gets an hour up the road, bails out, and they catch him on CCTV. It then takes them like 4 days to find him, right? And you're like, an Iranian spy with British army training who has, like, shown initiative enough to escape a prison. They find him an hour up the road, 4 days later. Like, he's in fucking South London, like 90 minutes for the prison.
That's insane.
And you're like, took him 4 days to find the guy that didn't even leave the fucking neighbourhood. You know what I mean? Like, and you're just like, the whole, that's what I'm saying, there's not a bit of UK life just now that is influenced by the Tory party at Westminster that is not in total and utter shambles.
Uh-huh.
Like, the whole thing is chaos. There's MPs resigning. Did you see fucking Doris finally resigned?
Uh-huh.
Did you see her interview?
I didn't see that.
Oh my God, man. It is honestly, we'll maybe try and drop some clips in, but like one is, like, you're talking about America where it's completely separated from any actual reality. And she literally sat in front of a camera, smiled, and spent 20 minutes talking the most unhinged bullshit that I've ever heard in my life. Like, honestly, if you've not seen it, look it up. Like, the woman is a fucking crackpot. And the press just said, oh, yeah. 2 days of, like, just mad, random, crazy quotes for her. And you're just like, no, there's a resignation after resignation. They're dropping like flies.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, we're no standing for re-election and we're no coming back. They know they're beat. And they've just gave up. And like, call the election. Just date it. What are we clinging on how for long, here? Like, this is over.
How long have we got to wait? May? Next year?
I think 24? It's in that ballpark, but it's getting to the point now where I think it'll be before that. But
right.
He needs something, Sunak needs something that he can hang his hat on ahead of it. And right now, all he's got is just shambles and chaos. I mean, you're getting into, like, Prime Minister's questions. I don't know if you've seen the footage of, like, Penny Mordaunt, the Navy officer who's, like, probably never set a foot on a boat in her life, but makes the one that was, like, hodding the sword during the...
Isn't she
so good for standing still holding a sword for an hour? And you're like, okay, if that's what does it for you, you know what I mean? Like, so she is very much looking to me like the kind of... If Boris doesn't make the pure WWE style comeback where, you know, they fucking smash cut to him like kicking open the Westminster and like being, I'm back.
Aye. Like, what Trump's trying to do in America.
This is the next one, so as Mordaunt.
Right.
And she's a horrible bitch. Pardon the language in that respect, but
how,
like, she's
a horrible
bastard. How do
you get to become
bastard.
Somebody who gets to hold... Is she... I suppose what I'm asking, is she related to the monarchy in any way? Like, what?
No, so I think she is like, she's either like chief whip or she is like leader of the house or something like that. So she is, where it's one of these very like administrative positions within the party at Westminster, and it entitles you to that. That is your responsibility as that person within Westminster. And maybe like Jacob Rees-Mogg was previously like leader of the house sort of type
thing.
He
wouldn't have been able, to be fair, I think that's maybe that's why the BBC have been like, well, look, because Jacob Rees-Mogg wouldn't have been able to stand there for an hour. Like, his wrist would have broke. Like, he's pure waif. Do you know what I mean? Like, made
the actual,
a fucking
like,
waif on.
Four-foot like sword would have, like, tipped him out and disbalanced him. You know what I mean? Like, but Morton's just constantly talking Scotland this, Wales that, and she's just horrible. She's a nasty, nasty piece of work with no meaningful, like, actual policy behind her or anything like that. But then they are... But I think she's the one, and she was sitting the other day there, Sunak's getting it, Prime Minister's questions, and somebody caught a video of her, and she's sitting there huffing and rolling her eyes, and like, just like being like a petulant child.
Publicly disagreeing.
Like, publicly, I without ever going, oh, I don't agree with anything he's saying, but she's there, oh, fucking oof, and you're just like, that is so childish. Uh-huh. Like, but it's, that's, she's speaking to people with the mentality of school children. Aye. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
so there's something about, and I don't even think, I suppose, like, I'm not entirely sure because I don't see any other parliaments around the world, but there's something about UK politics that is kind of childish, the way that they go and the way that they sort of deal with each other. And it's like, always, the one that always gets me was when I think maybe Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party at the time, and obviously there's stuff about, and we spoke about this in previous, like, long ago when this happened, but they decided to change unemployment benefit for whatever it was called to universal credit. Yep. And it was a way of sort of getting two fingers to the universal basic income. And
it was.
Ian Duncan Smith was stunning like that. Like, I think at Corbyn and McDonald at the other side. And that is the level, that is the sort of mentality. Like, and we talk about, like, people think, you maybe get people who'll be like, but that's part of it, and you're like, but you can't just switch that on and off. Like, you're either a cunt or you're not a cunt. Like, you can't walk into Parliament and be an absolute fucking spiteful, childish, arrogant arsehole for like 4 hours of your day and then come out and be like, right, well, now that's over and done with, I'm back to being a nice guy.
Maybe somebody should explain that to Matt Hancock, you know what I mean?
Well,
or whoever else pops up on Dancing with the Stars next, or whatever the fuck it is.
Trying,
you know,
to whitewash their fucking...
There's going to be a tsunami of them after the next election. You know what I mean? Like, placeholding to the next time they can actually get themselves back in. You know, popping up on daytime TV chat shows and panels and game shows.
Look at fucking Liz Truss has got a book deal. Who's gave Liz Truss a fucking book deal? She's wrote a book about economics. Like, they presided over the single worst ever fucking budget. Aye. And she's wrote a book about, it's like, what the fuck is going on here?
And she almost bankrupted the entire country overnight.
Uh-huh. Do you know what we should do?
£85 billion she cost us, and she's talking about economics.
We should pitch a show. I think Channel 4 would be up for it, where we put this current Tory cabinet on the barge with a Legionnaire's disease and see if they can survive.
They've also got like a selection of like different weapons hidden on the barge. A bit of a battle royale.
We could do the Stanford Prison Experiment.
That would work.
Rishi Sunak's cabinet.
Yep. I've always wanted to do the reality TV show where, like, you know, everybody gets their own cell or room, as they might refer to it, but it's a cell. And like the public vote every week to just execute one of them. And whoever wins is the last one that survives, and we'll let them back off.
Uh-huh.
But the rest of them need to go.
That way where they're walking on, they've been, all their contracts has been like, you'll have a room. And then they walk into the set and they're like, why does that say cell? And they're like, oh, mm-hmm. Sorry. There's another wee sign that goes out of that says rooms, like, sorry. And then they're like, this feels like a cell. It's a room. Oh, right, okay. Gaslight them the way they fucking gaslight everybody else.
You know what I mean? Like, I've definitely watched that shit, especially if they were getting executed. But, as I say, I don't expect anything from them or of them, because they are an absolute shower of shite and always have been. But in the last sort of 4 to 6 weeks, we have really, like, We've tipped to an edge here in the country where you're just like, the economy's in a state, these guys cannot fix it. Like, they're even starting to, like,
they don't want to fix it.
Well, they don't, but they're even starting to, like, quietly, like, re-sign back up to certain EU programs and stuff like that. Uh-huh. So, like, you the know, we got Brexit done, but you're like, so can we get in on this? And they're like, why, whatever. You know what I mean? So the EU is very much like, I'm on a cross. Like, there was never a beef. Like, uh-huh. It was all you. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like,
that's it.
So, there's no consistency. There's no direction. There's no moral compass. There never has been. It has been like, if it's no nailed down, lift it. It was the thing the Germans did, you know. So the scorched earth policy at the end of World War II. What was it? There's like a pure German word for it, but I can't remember. And it's like, but
they just moved to Argentina.
They just lifted every bit of art and gold and, you know, just anything across mainland Europe that wasn't nailed down, they were like, mine.
Moved it to the Vatican.
Bagsy.
100%.
Or sitting in a Swiss vault somewhere, you know what I mean?
I was thinking Soviet, the fall of the Soviet Union is a bit like this, where, you know, guys were flying over for America and walking into warehouses, and guys that were generals in the Soviet army were like, how many tanks do you want? How many AK-47s do you want to ship off to, like, whatever fucking country that you're trying to destabilise?
Exactly.
Exactly.
It's kind of ironic, because it's almost like Britain is the barge.
It basically is
a metaphor for ourselves.
It does feel like it. That's a good fucking point, mate, actually.
It's surreal being in this, though, isn't it? Because, like, you've got...
You
get like Stephen Fry on the BBC basically being like, do you realise how stupid we look to the rest of the world? Like, and the BBC being like, well, there's some things, and he's like, don't kid yourself.
I was just like, Hans Zimmer done. And she was just like, all right.
The rest of the world is looking at us and laughing, you know. And it's like,
not even that. There's the Chinese.
Well, Europe.
I've seen the Chinese guy. I don't know if you've seen it, Shep, but there was one that was like, I can't remember who it was, like Jeremy Vine or some one of the pricks. And like, they were talking to a guy for like the Chinese Foreign Office.
Right.
And they were talking about, you know, Britain's place in the global market. And there'd been this deal struck between Russia, China, the EU, America, Australia, and everybody, basically everybody in the world except the UK.
All the African countries. Is this like the opposition to NATO, basically?
No, this was like a trade deal sort of thing. It might be the beginnings of something, but it involved America and all these other places, including like China, Russia, and all the rest of it. And the only people pretty much excluded on the global scale were the UK. And
I think the US were excluded.
Possibly.
It's the same one that I'm thinking of. It was very much basically everyone who wasn't the West.
Right. So. Maybe. But at the same time, well, Russia are doing a lot of work in like Asia and Africa, they know. So we might be talking about separate things. But this particular one was like, they had the Chinese dude on to talk about how, you know, this deal was going to happen and why Britain were excluded. And he was like, so, I mean, how did China feel about excluding one of its biggest competitors? And this wee Chinese dude was like, mate, the fuck are you talking about? And he was like, what?
Who?
And he was like, you're not our competitor.
Competing in what?
And he was like, this thing, it started rhyming off. He was like, so we build cars, Like, you don't build cars. Like, we are the leading manufacturer in electric vehicles. You don't build electric vehicles. We are technology. The leading in green infrastructure and technology. You don't build any
We're
of that. Like,
nuclear power
and he went
plants.
Through point yeah. by point by point. And then he was basically at the end of it, like, Pierre, talk to me about how we're competitors. And the English guy was just looking at it like, I've got nothing. And you're like, aye. Because, like Paul says, on a global scale, the UK is a joke. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it's the UK was only able to compete because it was an empire. Like, let's face it. I mean,
that
like
was 150 years
no,
ago.
No, I but we're talking about the remnants. We've been making money off the back of it for a long time.
Oh, aye.
But what I mean is, like, as a country, we're very small. In fact, I would say that our biggest output really to the world is ingenuity, invention. Like, what we do is we come up with a new
Way
thing, and we
money.
Bring it to the world, and we also like make money off the back of that.
Yeah,
that's fine. Like, we've got the oldest colleges and universities in the world, with Oxford and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are like, yeah, of course, Scotland's produced Jesus, like some of the best technological advances in the bloody
yeah.
world, right? So this is what we do, but like, yeah, we're never going to compete on manufacturing and stuff, and neither we should. But what we should be doing is able to be self-sufficient for our own stuff,
mm-hmm.
because you can't.
This is the thing, right?
We're
is
not.
That, like,
we're
not I'm talking about like manufacturing is that they deindustrialized us because it was cheaper to get it for
yeah.
these places. Now it's not cheaper to get it for these places, and they're, you know, I mean, I think there's been many political people that have spoken about it, but guys like Trump were talking about the reindustrialization, and I know that he's a fucking moron. He's like, I'm going to bring back coal, and everybody was like, well, no, you're no. But why don't we reindustrialize?
Well, I mean, Bidenomics has brought manufacturing back to America in the last 2 years on a scale that has never been seen before. Like, and that's something we can maybe talk about down the line, because we've not talked about America for a while, but I think, like, this week, maybe, like, keep it UK stuff, but there's so much of the Trump and Biden stuff to get into that I don't think we can do it like justice in like 20 minutes.
No, absolutely
an hour.
Not.
But at the moment, Biden's economic plan in America
is to reindustrialize.
Is basically, but he's invested a 10-year plan that has created more jobs in 2 years than any president has ever created in a 4-year term. Like, American inflation at the moment is like just under like 1.5%.
But can we
it's say
like
a quarter of what it is anywhere else in the world. Like, he's created 13.9 million jobs.
But is it really? Because like these things. No, everybody knows you don't get elected, put something in place within a month. It then takes fruition within. Like, this is all. This must be to some degree a historic thing that he's reaping the benefits of in his term, or
so
somehow is
not really because
his muscles.
What he's doing is not necessarily building plants or whatever it is. What he's doing is he's fixing roads, he's fixing bridges,
right.
He's putting infrastructure in place all across the country that makes it easier and cheaper for companies to exist there, which wasn't the case before. It wasn't just about the bottom dollar about how many people you hire and what size of building you've got. It's about other infrastructure there to get our products out to the rest of the world, and in America had fell behind to an extent that he is now reversing, that has actually led to a massive, just insane. I mean, this is like the American economy is booming in a way that it hasn't done since the end of World War II.
So it's not really, it like, doesn't sound like it's a number that can be maintained then, because that infrastructure, once it gets to a point, they haven't got the, so they're not manufacturing, which is what we've just said.
Their
investing in industry
is,
which has created
booming.
Jobs, but that doesn't mean that they're like, if they need chips for computers for their cars.
But what I'm saying is, by
abroad.
Every standard that the G7 and the G20 measure economies by, America is pretty much at the moment
top of every single one. Everything. I'd seen something about
so
that.
Again, I don't have all the immediate figures to hand, but as I say, he's created 14 million jobs in like 2 years, and you know, these are just like headlines. So there is an argument that we did deindustrialize, we have not reindustrialized, and some other countries like America are now taking advantage of that. So there, because they can see that other countries are stepping away from it, and now they're trying to invest in ways to make America a more appealing place to invest. And that, and at the moment, it is actually working extremely well. But I some of that stuff will maybe, as I said, get into another episode in the coming weeks, because their detachment from reality over there at the moment is on a scale that I don't think anybody anywhere has ever seen before, where an entire country of 300-some million people has basically half of the population in a complete fantasy land and total denial as to what's going on. But again, as I say, we'll like deep dive on that another time. Maybe as some of the court cases kick off or whatever else it is. I think moving on for like the wider sort of UK context, like bringing it back to a more sort of Scottish thing, in the last sort of week or so, we've had the decision for the Lord Advocate to allow the trial for safe drug consumption rooms. Something that we have been pretty vocal about. We've had guys like Paul Sweeney, who has worked on this. I mean, again, there's no a lot of things we necessarily agree with Paul. He's a great guy. I think he's very well-intentioned and comes from the right place, which we don't see for a lot of our politicians. Got a lot of respect for him in that regard. He is obviously a unionist, and we don't agree on that, but this is something in terms of like the drug consumption things that guys like him, Peter Crikin and whatnot, and other people, we've talked about harm reduction. And, you know, you go back through the back catalogue, especially if you're discovering this for the first time with some of the newer stuff that's out there, like go back and you know, explore some of those things, because we've talked about them at length repeatedly. So to see that change come in and then also get the confirmation that the UK government would not intervene, feels like a really big step forward for me.
Like, it can't be understated how big a step forward that is. I know that, I think, like, there was chat of, you know, the Scottish government under Humza wanting to decriminalise drugs, and the UK government have said that they wouldn't let that go.
The conversations get very hyperbolic.
So that's like, I think that gets people's, when you hear the news of like that gets people's expectations really like massive. And then, you know, you come back down to earth. But the trial for safe consumption is a huge step in the right direction for me. For not only for you know, swathes of communities and the addiction community, you know, and people that suffer for addiction. Like, I mean, currently, mate, I was in an NCP car park and seen a guy jacking up the other day, man, and you're just like, you know. Yep. If we go back to when we were young, I think if I was an adult back then, my attitude would have been a fucking scumbag. And, well, fucking, there's Wayne's about here, and you're in town, and you're pretty much in a public place, you're just off of the street. I think generally the attitude towards it is that people, they need help. Like, the way that we've been dealing with chronic drug use, addiction, has just no worked, and we need a complete different direction, and this seems to be a good step in that direction. Step.
And I think it's important that we underline that, right, because a lot of fanfare has come off the back here for people who were in favour of these types of changes, and a lot of vitriol has came in the other direction.
Yep.
And take just one wee moment, we were approached recently on this by a sort of previous friend of the show. It didn't work out with personal stuff, so apologies that we didn't get back to you, but at the same time, we're going to get into it here because it literally just happened, all right? and, you know, for me, it's a step. It's no silver bullet. It's no an end result. It's no the finishing point. It is the starting point. And like you say, having been an addict or being an addict, that humanization is something that is like vitally important to me. Like, it is the cornerstone of how I believe we resolve this issue. Mm-hmm. And it's by treating people like human beings, no treating them like statistics, no treating them like underclass. And these are things that as a society we have been guilty in the past. I know as well that I cringe when I hear other people use the term junkie now. I always personally use the term addict, and it's come from my own experiences with drugs and alcohol, and I think now about how I wanted to be treated and how and what saved me and what enabled me to save myself. And it was empathy. It was the care of other human beings around me. It was the understanding of other human beings around about me. And it's no a silver bullet. It's no a victory. It's, you know, we've no won the war. We've maybe like just won a battle. And hopefully it'll be the first of many battles that we win on this road that we're on to hopefully recognising the inert human dignity of people and making that the centre of our policy, the centre of our action when it comes to this type of thing. We have a lot of people that talk the talk, and now we have an opportunity to start walking the walk, and I think it starts here. Some of the criticism, not unfair, right? A lot of other addicts who are out there are very, you know, people who have worked the 12 steps and stuff like that, very determined about abstinence only, and if that's your perspective, cool. If it's worked for you, great. But having my experience of addiction, I wasn't always ready to get better.
Yeah.
As much as I might have wanted it, as much as I might have thought maybe I can try now, like, I wasn't always ready for it. I wasn't always ready to take that step. And had there been time and space for me to reduce the harm that I was doing to myself while I got ready, then I think that would have been a valuable resource.
Yeah.
And I think that's where these safe consumption rooms slot in to a wider picture.
It's that shift, isn't it? Like, I was just looking there. I was listening to you, but I was just looking there. It's 2/3 of people that enter recovery fail.
Yep.
So we're looking at something.
And some of them fail repeatedly.
We're looking at something that doesn't work for the majority of people.
Yep.
People that are that have done the steps, that have been through that, like, you are almost a statistical anomaly in a sense, and you should look at yourself like that. Like, I am lucky and privileged that I managed to get through
and
the steps.
And take pride in it as
and
well.
And take pride in it, because it does take, you know, like, we're both addicts and it takes some amount of fucking grit and determination to get through it.
Oh.
Sometimes you're white knuckling it, do you know what I mean? And you need the support of other people. But it's the shift. I think this is the start of the shift for drug use away from criminal health, because it is a mental illness. Addiction is a mental illness.
Yep.
The actual addiction and the drug use in itself is a symptom of a wider problem.
Yep.
And we can, and I think that abstinence based, it works for a third of people, and it does work then. So
yeah,
it's proven to work, right? And it does work. But for the majority of people, it doesn't work. So we need to continue to evolve and to open our minds and to try different things. And giving somebody a clean needle, giving somebody a place to go that isn't a fucking high-rise car park to take their medicine, what is the medicine that they've found, because that's the way that I view it, is that people are medicating themselves.
Yep.
They get the opportunity to come away out of an alleyway, out of a car park, away from a place where, you know, Glasgow City Centre, there's still people out there that would probably attack somebody if they seen them, you know what I mean?
And yep.
We're giving people dignity, we're giving people safety, they're not going to be sharing needles, there's not going to be blood-transmitted diseases.
Yep.
There's so many benefits for the people that are in the addiction, the people that are going to use this. But that's part of the sort of comeback for it, is well, fuck them. They've chose this.
Yep.
And it's like, how many people, and I know this is a trope, but how many people do you see coming out of Newton Mearns and Bell's Den that end up a fucking heroin addict? Literally none.
Mm.
Like, this isn't fuck them. This is trauma. This is, like, historical. These people have been abused. They are now in horrific circumstances. They're putting themselves, I get it, they're putting themselves in dangerous situations. They're taking Class A drugs, they're injecting on the street, they're ending up in crowds of people that, you know, they're going to end up with more abuse, more trauma.
Yep.
So we're trying to find ways to stop that, because one thing's for sure, they're going to take the drugs.
Until you can break the cycle, let's try and slow it down.
Exactly, or, you know what I mean? Make it safe to be in.
Yep.
Whatever addictive cycle that people end up finding themselves in, like, give people dignity and safety.
I don't think classifying it as writing people off to drug addiction is fair. I don't think, because I think that if you're in a safe, clean environment with educated professionals who can, if you choose, put you in touch with recovery services, who know who to contact and when, what types of support people might need. Like, the recovery room, and it might sound daft to say it, the recovery room is the gateway. The way that, you know, weed might be the gateway drug, like, maybe these recovery rooms are the gateway to recovery, because people go and are treated like an actual fucking human being and actually maybe think to themselves, well, what else can this place give me? What else can these people give me that will help me? How I feel respected, I feel treated like a person for the first time in maybe ever, maybe years, who knows? I mean, like, to then be like, oh, we're just geeing up. Well, that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is actually, for me, picking a longer, harder road, because the end goal is to get people off of drugs.
Uh-huh.
We're not geeing up on them. What we're saying is, we are here for you no matter what.
Exactly.
Like, we will care for you and we will provide for you as and when needed, for as long as is needed. And sorry, Shep, what were you going to say, mate?
I was just going to say, it gives some people a chance to actually wake up that day and go down an abstinence route or go down whatever route it takes. But, like, it's going to save lives. Like, that's also a big factor. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's more harm eradication, it's harm reduction.
The amount of money it's going to save off the NHS is probably ridiculous.
Potentially, yeah. Like, this is what the trial will teach us.
Exactly.
We don't want to prejudice it. We don't want to make any judgments. We've seen elements of what has went on in other countries, but these other countries are culturally and societally different from us, so we cannot make assumptions.
Like, it's colder
here. The trial has to be scientific, and we cannot jump to conclusions before it even happens. So it might be that for this country it doesn't work, and it doesn't give us the benefits. We need to be prepared for that. Like, that is a reality that can happen. So we can't just jump out and be like, this is a win. Like, this is, like Paul says, a step in the right direction.
Aye.
And another one of the criticisms I've heard is, well, people aren't getting on a bus to, like, take drugs. And you're like, have you been in Glasgow City Centre?
Putting it in the city centre, right?
Go and take a lap around Central Station. Again, not going to mention my employer, but I know for a fact that right now the First Minister of Scotland is at an event that 150 yards from the front door of that event, there is absolutely people in a neighbouring alleyway taking drugs and sleeping rough. Right? So that is the city centre right now. That is stone's throwing distance from Central Station. So it is, like, take a lap around Central Station. Date on a Saturday night, a Friday night, when the homeless charities are out feeding people, when the street teams are out.
Yeah.
Tell me that a safe consumption room in Glasgow City Centre will do zero good. Like, it's just not true.
Aye.
Like, if it helps one person, even if they don't ultimately get off it, if it saves their life, it saves them from disease, it saves them from spreading sickness around their friends and whatever else, it was worthwhile. Like, it's about reduction. It's about saying you are worth this effort, and we believe that you are worth this effort. And that's where it is for me, because I say that dignity is something that is hugely important to me in my recovery, is that I actually recognised that I was a person, that I wasn't just this fucking thing that was just driven by just the constant fucking need for more, you know what I mean? Like, and other people will realise it. Like, it might not be the new, might not be in a year, but, like, as this progresses and hopefully proves some of the things that we hope it will prove, we can then start to see it expand to the local communities where people are taking these drugs at home, and, you know, the other places, you know, parks and whatever else it happens to be. But this is just the trial. This is just the first step. And if we're going to say that we care about people's dignity, and we're going to say that we care about people's recovery, then we can't object to this, no matter what path to recovery you believe in. Because if the end goal is that people are cared for and helped and ultimately they get better, then why would we be against that?
No.
Just because it doesn't follow your specific dogma, whether that be sort of religious, whether that be, you know, based on your own individual recovery, whether that be, you know, just you know, the misconceptions that people have about addiction and stuff like that, or older thinking, you know what I mean, previous stereotypes and tropes that you're talking about, you know what I mean, like, would we lose by trying it? You know what I mean? I don't think we lose anything.
We don't lose anything, really. You know?
I mean, look, we're putting $1.8 billion into this barge. Like, I'm pretty sure that the funding for this is not even going to scrape the edges of that. Like,
and as you say, so the potentials that are saved.
Exactly. So how can it? How could it? It can only be a positive.
But what better? Like, if it does work as well, like, what better way to engage with people that are vulnerable, desperate, and in need of, like, care, whether it be, you know, they need a bed, they need, you know, psychotherapy, they need trauma therapy, they need, you know, whatever they might need. What better place where they're coming to you rather than you having to go up to somebody that, like, I mean, God love the people that do this.
Yeah.
I don't even, you know, I know you're a religious person, but God love people that do this. They approach people on the street and try and engage them in the support that's there for them. Yep. Look, do you know that this is available? These people are sceptical, hurting, traumatised. You know, they've probably never met a human being that's actually treated them with dignity, or some of them at least.
No, definitely.
And these people are having to go up to them in the street and try and engage them. But if you're like, look, we're offering a service, and it's a service that they want and need, and they're coming to you, then you can engage that person in a conversation and
because the inkling's already there.
How did you get here? And then be like, do you know that this is available to you, and this charity's there that can maybe get you a therapist, or they can get you sorted with a flat, or whatever it might be. There's so many services there that people just don't have a fucking clue exist, and you can engage them by going to these places.
These people don't have phones, or, you know what I mean, like, the infra, you know, the day-to-day stuff that you would need to take. Like, you know, if you or I experienced an issue with homelessness, we would have resources available to us to instantly be like, right, what do I need today to resolve this? But again, how do you get that when you're sleeping, you know, between two bins in an alleyway?
Your whole,
you know what I mean, like,
your whole life is literally fight or flight. Full life is just, how do I get through this day? How do I get my medicine? And how do I wake up tomorrow morning? Because, like, literally, like, they take their life into their hands by walking the streets at night, and or, like, whatever they're going.
I hope, to be honest with you, that as well as this being, like, hopefully the first step in a wider conversation about how we address drugs and attitudes towards drugs and attitudes towards addicts, like, it needs to go even bigger. We need to be having a conversation about the wider elements that lead, because you said earlier on, and you were absolutely fucking right when you said it, that addiction is just the symptom of the trauma that somebody's experiencing elsewhere, right? Or your word to that effect. Mm-hmm. So we need to look at how people, particularly young people, are exposed to abuse through care, through family, through whatever it is. We need to look at poverty properly, because the stress that that puts on families, again, like when we spoke about ACEs and stuff like that, these are the issues that drive this behaviour. And if we can take a more empathetic and more humanistic approach to the sickness that people have as a result of these traumas, we need to extend it beyond that. And this is where I say this is hopefully the first step.
Aye.
We can recognise people's inherent human dignity and put that at the centre of our approach to them. We need to go the whole way.
Yeah.
We need to go the whole hog
And
actually start as a society to address these things that drive people
to
these illnesses.
It's unconditional, isn't it? It's like, I was talking to, I had actually met Natalie from Cisco for the first time. She came in to do another podcast. Now,
I seen that.
We did Natalie on Rebel City, like, during the pandemic. I think it was during the first lockdown. Pretty sure we did it over Zoom, and actually a really good podcast, and did some really great numbers. And
it's
some,
like, one of our all time best. Did thousands.
And it was talking, and Natalie was saying that, I think, as we're talking about, like,
they also do a great recovery cafe at Celtic Park. For anybody who is thinking about how they engage with these types of services, like,
100%.
Look up Cisco, they're a fucking phenomenal organisation.
But it's like that shift for, like, the punishment culture.
Aye.
To like this idea that we can have unconditional compassion for people. Like, instead of just judging people based on the person that presents with, say, like a set of actions, like somebody who's shoplifting, like this week it's been record numbers of shoplifting. Yep. And how do we tackle this? Guess what? You stop people from fucking starving. These people on the people don't want to go in and steal for Tesco.
They were talking about it being organised gangs. You know, organised gangs are not going in and stealing fucking sliced
ham.
What
a load of fucking pish. It is people who are absolutely going in and stealing. Like, I think they were saying that one of the top five things that's stolen is like nappies, and another one's baby formula. Like, that is why people are fucking shoplifting.
Aye.
It's got nothing to do with, you know, the entitlement of these people, and they just want a free ride and blah blah blah. Like, we're past it. It's bullshit. That's how they sell you and put them in the prison.
Aye.
Get them away from you. Like, see, like, we were talking earlier, like, about the barge. I forgot to say, like, I can remember sitting in rooms with adults as a child where they were like that, and excuse the slur, right? Do you know what we need to do with these junkies? Stick them on a fucking island away from everybody, because that's all that they're... That's, just let them go and murder each other.
Aye.
I can remember actual adults in my life sitting there and...
Aye.
So that's the level of thinking that we've got at a government level, but... That's the attitude that just needs to change more towards the idea of, like, how did you get here? Like, that's the humanist approach. It's gone, like, you're a human being, and I know that you're no bad in inception. So how did you end up at this point? Because, one, we need to stop it from happening to future generations of people. But, two, I'm pretty confident there's something that we can do about it for you. And
yep.
We can help you through that journey. It's not going to be easy. I think anybody that's been through a journey that involves addiction, that involves trauma, is never going to be like, I was a piece of piss and I sailed through it. No, it's going to be like the battle of a lifetime. But within the next decade...
And you'd be lucky if you only have to fight it once.
Exactly. But within a sort of 5 to 10 year period, you can completely change the narrative about who you are as a person,
yep.
What you're about, and where you're going with your life, because there's nothing that you can do about the road that's behind you. Like, all that you can do is learn for that.
Exactly.
But that's the thing that we don't do, isn't it? It's like, we don't look at the road previously trod and go,
if we could punish our way out of this situation,
we would live in a utopia.
We would have done it already.
We would be in a utopia, wouldn't we? Like, exactly. Aye. We've done enough fucking punishing people, like, and that's exactly where the, you know, people are talking about, like, where's the rehabs and where's this? They turned them onto prisons. They put them onto prison. That's how they decided to do it.
And we're not saying stop rehab, we're saying do it. Like, this should not be the be all and end all. This should be one tool in an arsenal that is stacked to the rafters of, you know what I mean? That should be recovery beds. It should be the ability to engage with abstinence if that's what you choose. It should be that you can make use of services and look after yourself while you're going through it. Like, all these things should be available. We should be doing all of them. It should not be either or. And when you can spend £2.8 billion on a fucking barge, or you can write off £14 billion in tax fraud, as Sunak did this week, like, we can do this. We can fund this. But the attitudes, need to continue to change. And in our lifetime, we've went for kill the fucking lot of them to no. That's an actual human being that we need to show some actual care and attention to. And that is a gigantic leap forward in just our lifetime. We need to keep on the road, and we need to keep having these conversations and actually, like, keep, you know, getting behind guys like Paul and that who are out there pushing.
100%. You know what I mean? Like, I think for me, there's a bit of a shock in my end to how naive... to, like, how much change can actually happen and what should be celebrated and what should be, like, really spoke about and being like, this is a big change and we should take note of this, rather than being like, it's not enough. Do you know what I mean? And, like, even I'm guilty of that, being like, this isn't enough, we need to do more. But there's also, like, that, like you're saying, like, it's a step in the right direction, and if we just keep on focusing on, like, no, but we need to be doing more, and that's not enough. It's like, you'll get no joy for it, rather than being like, right, great, what can we do next? Exactly. Rather than like, how do we get to this end goal? It's like, what's the next step on this journey for, you know, for us, I suppose, because we're part of that community of people, you know what I mean? And it's no, I'm not sitting and being like, I'm an addict, or I was an addict, but, you know, I never stuck a needle in my arm. It's like, I just didn't end up and the set of circumstances that that presented as an option to me. Yeah. Because any other option that was presented to me, I fucking took with both on. So I'm no, you know, bigging myself up enough to be like, I could never be like that.
I think the only drug I did take was putting a needle in my arm. You know what I mean? Like, I think I probably ticked off all the rest at one point or another. You know what I mean? Like, but again, I don't know that that opportunity was ever... Had it immediately been in front of me, maybe I would have. I don't know. It's hard to tell. Exactly.
Just the group of people that you ended up...
I had no control, so it's impossible for me to say in hindsight. You know what I mean? Like, I'd like to think I wouldn't, but I've done some shit. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
How do we want to try and wrap up? Where have we got? Any other business, gents?
I'm happy with that, to be perfectly honest. I think we've done about an hour and 15, haven't we?
We've done pretty good at an hour and 20.
Aye, man. I don't have anything else, really.
No. Okay. So... Guys, again, if you're engaging here, thank you so much. Like, all likes, shares, comments are greatly appreciated. We're going to cut up this into some smaller sections as we did the last time. Should we be in the coming days, and then every sort of 4 or 5 days after that until we're back in the studio. So, again, thank you so much for the way you engaged last week, and let's have Mary the same this week, please.
Thank you.
Beautiful. We managed to not call somebody batshit crazy after that YouTube comment. Like,
oh, did somebody? Aye, that